Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the new screensavers is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. The new screensavers is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/NSS.
A 3D printed safe cracking robot, starting a digital cleanse, a review of tiny reference monitors, and more. Live from the Twit Eastside Studios in beautiful Petaluma, it's the new Screensavers!
Job. Thank you very much. What's your name?
Joe.
From somewhere in the high desert of Southern California. Great to see you, Joe, and Kira, his wife. And welcome to the new Screensavers. I'm Leo Laporte. Look who's here.
Always a pleasure to come back, yes.
Your name is?
Nathaniel.
Ian Thompson of theregister.co.uk. Episode 117, recorded Saturday, August 12th. 2017. Do you ever do that when you don't know somebody's name? Like you're saying
brain fart.
You're like, look who's here. It's.
I get that at conferences a lot. It's just like everyone's, oh, great to see you again. It's like, oh, hi, lovely to see you again.
Who the hell are you? I realize now an actual condition that exists.
Oh, really?
And I it's not been diagnosed in me, but I believe I have this condition where I
one of those.
Yeah, I looked it up. I can't remember what it's called, but you can't remember faces at all.
Is that aphasia? No, that's words.
I can't. It's like aphasia, but it's for faces. Aphasia. But I cannot, for the life of me, I can't even, like, in my head, see my own kids' faces. I can't see. Can you do that? Like, can you see Monica's face if you think, close your eyes and see her in front of you?
Yeah, generally, no.
Oh, that's it. Prosopagnosia. Prosopagnosia.
Face blindness.
I think I actually have it. So that's my excuse if I don't remember your name. It's because I have prosopagnosia hobo.
I can remember people. I mentally attach people's faces to their email addresses. I don't know why, but it's just one of those things.
Mary Jo Foley, our Microsoft reporter from Windows Weekly, tells me that Steve Ballmer, the former CEO of Microsoft, can remember you by your shoes. He looks at your shoes. And he can. I know this is weird, but apparently it's an old salesman's trick. He looks at your shoes, and he could tell her any given time anybody he's met what shoes they were wearing. And apparently, somehow that connects up in his brain. Maybe he can't remember faces, but he can remember shoes.
Oh, good grief!
And now, you're wearing what we call trainers in the U.S.
Yes, what we call trainers in the U.K. as well. But I seem to be told they're called running shoes
here in the U.S. Oh, I've got it mixed up then.
Well, you know, these are made in the U.S. because I don't like the idea of 14-year-old Indonesian teenagers having to sew them together.
You can buy runners that are made in the United States. Who's that? What company does that?
New Balance.
New Balance. I wear New Balance, but I didn't realize I wasn't exploiting teenagers. Now I'll go back to
Adidas. That doesn't sound good, Leo.
Hey, we changed the subject. We have a great show. In fact, this is somebody you're excited because you saw the presentation at DEF CON.
Yes, and it was a classic.
This is a robot that cracked a safe from scratch in about 30 minutes.
Live on. I mean, they basically started up at the start of the thing and said, we're going to see if this actually works. And sure enough, it did. I think it was 32 minutes in.
It was created by Nathan Seidel, who is the founder of one of my favorite places to buy parts and project stuff, SparkFun. I didn't realize this, but he actually founded SparkFun and he built the robot. So that's kind of cool. We'll talk about that. In fact, we're going to get Nathan on and we'll demonstrate. If your digital life is a mess, don't worry. Megan Maroney begins a 10-part series. For me, it might be a 100-part series. A digital cleanse. She's going to begin with notifications. We have calls for help, two of them back to back. We've never done that before. It's a first, ladies and gentlemen. The first time ever.
Breaking new ground.
Breaking new ground with back to back calls for help. We've got Jason Howell with a review of some reference speakers. Maybe you're ready for some better speakers for your computer, something like that. We got a lot of stuff, questions in the mailbag, but let's start with a hot topic. Some very interesting stories in the news today. One I thought, and I tweeted this, and I got a lot of hate in the Twitter.
Oh,
amazing.
Who'd have thought it?
I said, I pointed out that Consumer Reports has yanked its recommendation of Microsoft's Surface products.
Yes.
That means they will not recommend them for purchase. And a lot of people on the Twitterverse said, "Well, whoever goes to Consumer Reports for tech reviews?"
Really? I thought it was a respected publication.
It's respectable. Certainly for home appliances,
yeah.
For cars. I kind of agree. I wouldn't buy a phone or a computer based on their review. But
no.
One thing they have, one data point they have, that other reviewers don't have. Typically, a reviewer in a tech publication will get a product. It usually is a loaner from the company.
Yep.
He'll or she will have access to it for a couple of weeks and have to send it back. Mm-hmm. That review will be based on merely 2 weeks' use.
Yeah.
That's enough to tell you whether it works out of the box, you know, form and fit and finish and all that. But it's not enough to tell you about long-term reliability.
True.
And this is where Consumer Reports, I think, has an advantage because they sent out a survey to every Consumer Reports subscriber. I'm one of them. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
Asking them about what they own and what their experiences have been, particularly with regard to reliability. That's been very useful in car purchases. They're doing it for computers now. And they say, we liked the Surface laptop. We liked the Surface Book, the Surface Studio.
Mm-hmm.
I own all of them. The Surface laptop, the Surface Pro. But I love my Surface Studio. But we found in our surveys of our readers that they don't hold up well. And in fact, I mentioned this on the radio today, and a guy called me up to commend Microsoft because he had a Surface Book that the battery had started swelling in, and it had visibly, it was, the screen was like this. And he said, but they replaced it. And so, that's good.
Yeah.
He said it was a year and a half old. Now, what he did say is I went to the store and I showed it to the guy. The guy said, well, I'll give you a $600 credit toward a new one.
Oh, for goodness sake.
And I said, that's actually not acceptable. If a battery is swelling, that's a prelude to exploding.
I was going
to
say, that's a massive fire risk for something that you hold over your,
yeah.
You know.
It's not good.
Veg, so,
it's not,
you know.
Good. He sent me the pictures. It's true. I saw it. I mean, it really was bad.
Yeah.
What any company should do, even if something's out of warranty, and certainly Apple will do this, if you've got a swelling lithium-ion battery,
it's
immediately
dangerous.
Discontinue use. Do not charge the device and send it or bring it to the manufacturer. Actually, you can't mail it. Bring it to the manufacturer or the store where you bought it and say, and they should exchange it. I don't care if it's 3 years old. They should exchange it because it's a hazard.
But they wouldn't. Once you get those ignited, they're very difficult to put out. And this is the problem airlines are having at the moment.
Right. So he called. He was kind of miffed. He went home, thought about it, called Microsoft. And fortunately got a rep on the line,
right.
And I think this is good advice, maybe if the store doesn't help, call them, who said, oh, no, we'll take care of that, we will replace it. And he said, don't mail it. We will have somebody come and get it. It's that dangerous. You can't put it in the mail. So maybe this confirms, that's a single data point, that's anecdotal evidence. I think little credit to Consumer Reports. When they say something is long-term reliability is not good, they have data that no one else really has except individuals, and that's unique to them. So estimated 2 year repair rates,
breakage rate
of 25%, that's way too high.
I know. I mean, this is traditionally not an area that Microsoft has been, hardware. Microsoft hardware is,
well, they're brand new. This is their first,
these
are the first computers they've ever built.
Yeah.
I think they're nicely made. I love them.
I've been using one of the Surface Fondle slabs for, about a year now, and I don't have any problems with it.
I've never seen any problems. I have a Surface slab. As I said, I have all but the Fondle slab. I think Alex has Fondle slab 4, right?
Yeah.
But we've not seen any problems with those. I think those are fairly reliable.
No, I mean,
but 25%, that's pretty high.
That is. I mean, they're reliable bits of kit. I would like to see more USB ports on there, but, it's...
Well, that's my biggest complaint, is they're still using that stupid Surface connector instead of a USB-C.
Oh, I know.
Charger.
Just
everybody, here's a Lenovo, newer Lenovo. This is the T470.
Oh, you've got the docking station as well.
Yeah. But this uses the old-fashioned proprietary Lenovo port.
Oh,
but,
for goodness.
Well, I agree, for goodness sake. But on the other side, a Type-C port that will also charge it.
Good.
And I think any new laptop computer, if it doesn't have Type-C charging,
no,
I have to say,
it.
regardless of the repairability or the reliability, dump it. Get a non, you know. And by the way, I have an HP that will only use an HP charger and it's Type C. That's not acceptable. I want it to charge, and this will charge with a Mac charger, with the HP charger, with anything. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I really like that. This is one of the last ones to still have the dock.
Yeah.
Connector, the old Lenovo. That's why I got the dock. I thought, well,
I mean, it
comes with a connector.
I spoke to the Surface people, and they were like, well, people like the old, you know, AB stuff.
No, they don't.
Because they've still
no
got a lot of stuff.
No one likes that.
Well, no, I mean, people have still got a lot of old kit, which can still use
look
it.
Look at this. This has plenty of USB ports.
Yeah, I mean,
it has three USB ports. It has a full-size
exactly.
Ethernet.
That's the Type-C connector and USB 3 are classic.
Just have a C. One C. That's all we ask, and you should be able to charge with that.
Well, unless you're Apple, in which case they just give you one C, which is, a ridiculous solution.
Not just one C.
One C. One is too few.
One's too few. Zero's too few. 10 would be too many.
No, yeah, true, but I guess you could maybe fix it.
They daisy chain. So one's enough.
Yeah.
One's enough. That's all I need. Did you see? I love this story. Wired Magazine. So we've talked before about how, in general, a virus to infect your system has to be an application, right?
Yes.
And the virus guy has to trick you into running it.
Mm-hmm.
With an email attachment, with a
social
plea.
Engineering.
Yeah, social engineering. But it is the case that a lot of things on your computer are applications, your fonts, for mm-hmm. instance. They're little programs that draw the letters. Even JPEGs couldn't be displayed without a program that draws the JPEG. And we've even seen in Microsoft's JPEG rendering library flaws that allowed a JPEG or a font or a PDF, depending on the application, to be crafted in such a way that could infect your computer, could take
yeah.
over your computer.
It's been a long-standing tradition.
Researchers have just created a strand of DNA that will infect a computer and let bad guys take over. Of course, you have to be running special software on the computer. If you're running a gene sequencer mm-hmm. on your computer and you sequence this maliciously crafted DNA, they'll pwn you. They'll pwn you. I love that.
Well, it's kind of, you know, they did it within a version of the operating system where they knew there was a flaw there, but then they converted.
Well, that's always the case, right?
Yeah.
So a data file, JPEG, font, DNA by itself can't do anything.
Hmm.
But there's always renderers.
Right.
And if the renderers have a flaw.
Yeah, then you can then exploit that.
Bingo.
Yeah, this is why Usenet security conferences are really spot on, because they come up with this kind of stuff and they have a very high bar.
This was announced not at DEF CON, but it's going to be announced Thursday at Usenix.
Yeah, Usenix in Vancouver.
Do you go to Usenix as well?
I go to the one in the Bay Area. I couldn't make this one because I, for various personal reasons, I couldn't actually get up there next week. But
I love these security conferences.
Oh, I mean, the first Usenix security conference they had down here, they had the head of the Tailored Access Operations Squad from the NSA speaking. I mean,
wow.
You never get this person on. And he was taking questions from the press. We had fun with that.
Now, I'm surprised you haven't noticed I have a bulge in my pocket.
I try not to look down there, to be honest.
And the old line, is that a bulge in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me? I have some Marmite in my pocket. I brought it just for you. Oh, this stuff is foul.
What do you mean? Have you ever actually tasted it?
I don't have to taste it. What is it? It's yeast, right?
It's brewer's yeast with vegetable extracts, a few flavors. It's terrifically good for you.
You know why it exists? Because brewers had it left over after making beer, and they said, is there any way we could make money on this? Put it in a jar. Ian will eat it.
Oh, me and loads of people. That's actually
very popular.
This is my travel pot of Marmite. So this is the one I take with me on my travel.
Well, this one isn't.
I have a catering pack back at home.
Look at this. It's very. I didn't. Is it? It doesn't. Does it pour?
My goodness, you did get your own. Yes.
Yeah.
Because
it's a fresh
just
jar.
So happened. I brought you up one as well.
We're the Marmite boys.
Seriously, just
news story.
Oh, inhale that deep beauty.
Mm.
Oh.
So what would you do? You could make a piece of toast.
Toast or crackers.
And you spread it on there.
My all-time favorite is scrambled egg on Marmite toast, which is my go-to comfort food. But I took this jar through Los Angeles and they explosives tested it because they were...
It looks like gelatinite. Does it pour?
No. No, it doesn't. Okay. But I do Marmite roast potatoes.
All right, well, I'm taking this home. We're going to have Marmite tonight, everybody. Come on over. The reason I bring this up is researchers have found that Marmite prevents birth defects.
Yes. Folic acid.
Oh, there's folic acid in it.
Oh, yes. I mean, two slices of Marmite toast, if you're getting ready to get pregnant or if you're pregnant, is your entire folic acid intake for the day.
That's B3?
Yeah. It's, I mean, tremendously good for you. And I'm aware that people don't like it, but, you know, you really should try it.
Right? It's an acquired taste.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I have a friend.
Did your mother feed you this as a baby?
Yes.
That's why.
But at the same time, my friend's kid hated it until she was 7 and then started loving it and smearing on everything. It's just like, I feel so betrayed.
It's a nutrition info on the inside, it says, so.
They actually market it. The marketing tagline is, you either love it or you hate it. Which you've got to admire the confidence of a company that can do that.
Yeah, look, there you go. Thiamine, riboflavin, niacin, folic acid. It has 825% of your minimum required value per 100 grams. Oh, you have to eat the whole bottle for that. No, I'm not going to do that.
No, nobody is going to eat the entire thing of that.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to visit. We're going to visit with one of the heroes of DEF CON this time around.
He gave one of the better presentations there. So. Certainly, I was really impressed with it.
Nathan Seidel is from the very nice Spark Fund, and we're going to do a safe crack with a robot coming up next. But first, a word from our sponsor, Rocket Mortgage. Robots, is there anything they can't do? One thing a robot could do, kind of a robot, a computer, it can get you mortgage approval. How about that? Wouldn't you like to do that and completely online? If you've ever bought a house or refinanced a house, you know that traditional banks, they make it paperwork, insane paperwork, and you have to fax it in. And we bought a house about almost 4 years ago. They kept asking for more and more, and a month later they kept saying, well, do you have, oh, you need your pay stub from 1994 and things like, it was crazy. Man, if they'd had Rocket Mortgage then, I would have been in there in a shot. Rocket Mortgage comes from Quicken Loans, one of the best lenders in the country. I'm going to venture to say the best if you look at their year after year J.D. Power Customer Satisfaction Awards. 7 years running is number one as a mortgage originator. They've actually made it a product for us, the geeks. It's called Rocket Mortgage. It's entirely online. You could do it from your phone, your tablet, your laptop. You could do it anywhere. You could do it in an open house. You say, let's buy this house. Okay, honey, how are we going to get a loan? RocketMortgage.com/NSS. You fire it up. You go there. You answer some questions. You don't have to do any paperwork. You can automatically share your financial information with a touch of a finger, which means, by the way, not only does it save you time, but it's, of course, going to be accurate. And then they will crunch the numbers in minutes, not days, months, weeks, minutes, to give you a yes or no. They'll show you the loans you qualify for based on your income, assets, and credit. They'll show you your rates, your terms that you can get, and you pick the rate of the loan. It's completely transparent. You know exactly what's going on. It's fast, fast, fast. Apply simply, understand fully, and then mortgage confidently. Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/NSS. If you're not buying a house this very, very minute, make a bookmark. So you'll remember the next time you're in an open house, hey, I got Rocket Mortgage in my pocket. Rocket Mortgage. Well, it's better than Marmite. RocketMortgage.com/NSS, equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans for their support. I love SparkFun. I've known about SparkFun for years. It's one of those places you can go. You can buy kits, buy stuff to make things. If you're a maker, SparkFun is awesome. And I highly recommend it. What I didn't know is that SparkFun's founder happens to be quite the hacker himself. Nathan Seidel is on the line. Am I saying your name right, Nathan Seidel?
You are. Yep, that's correct.
So nice to meet you.
Thanks for having me. This is amazing.
When did you found SparkFun?
To the very end of 2002, so it's been about 15 years.
That was you were early on, right? I mean, there wasn't a Raspberry Pi or an Arduino in sight.
No, it was a different world back then.
Yeah. Well, it's a great world now, and there's so much you can do. You built something with parts, I presume, from SparkFun.
We did, yeah. Pieced together with some 3D printing, an Arduino, a couple servos, a motor, and a power supply, and we were able to build a robot that opens up safes.
Oh!
Now,
The best part of DEF CON.
Yeah, now I gather this whole thing was spurred by your wife, who's a fellow hacker, and came up with an interesting idea for a present for you.
She, yeah, indeed. So Christmas, about whatever it was, 7-8 months ago, for Christmas, she bought me a safe that had no combination to it because she loves me very much and she knew I'm pretty into puzzles.
Wait a minute. Did she put a gift in the safe?
She actually just wrapped the safe because she didn't know the combination. She got it on Craigslist. It's super cheap.
It was like 20
because
bucks
the owner, yeah, it was 20 bucks. The owner said, hey, you can hire a locksmith if you want to open it up, but the locksmith is going to be more expensive than getting a new safe. So you know what? Whoever wants it, 20 bucks.
What a great gift.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really impressed with that.
Did you have any experience with safe cracking?
No, I'm just kind of into locks. I knew how to pick locks, but never, never knew how to crack a safe.
So she was encouraging a new hobby.
Yeah, a different profession than the one I've got, I guess.
Was this the same safe that you cracked at DEF CON?
It was not. You may or may not know, you can't really fly with a safe. It's kind of hard.
Well, they weigh a lot.
They do. So we actually had to fly to Vegas and then purchase a safe there in Vegas. And we got some very funny looks, one from our Lyft driver and two wheeling the safe through the casinos.
They
thought we were pretty cocky.
Oh, Lord. Just before we get to the cracking, I'll let you take it from here, Ian. But did you ever crack the safe your wife gave you?
Indeed. We originally wrote the tutorial probably back in March or April and said, hey, we're going to do this live on Ustream. And we cracked the safe in 41 minutes. And then we put together the DEF CON talk submission. I had never been to DEF CON before, but I said, hey, this could be a lot of fun. And DEF CON accepted the talk submission. So then we had to figure out how to do it live on stage in front of, I don't know how many people were in that room. It was a lot.
I was certainly one of them, yes. I mean, out of interest, what was the shot they gave you? Because traditionally at DEF CON, when you're a virgin speaker, you have to do a shot on stage before you give your presentation. And various people choose various different liquors. What did you go for?
Just Jack Daniels.
Ah, the classic. Right, yeah.
Smooth.
There's nothing like doing a shot of whiskey before a demo and then a 45-minute talk. It was one of the dumbest things I've done.
it's tradition. They actually banned it last year for health and safety reasons, and there was such an outcry they brought it back in. But you actually set the safe up to be unlocked during the presentation. You bet that you could get that 45-minute presentation will be enough time for you to break the code on the box, right?
Correct. We had a 45-minute.
There they are, cracking it. That's amazing.
Bravo.
We kind of gave away the happy ending. I got the impression from the quotes in the press that you were kind of not sure it would work.
Doing a demo at DEF CON is very strenuous, and we were confident in the robot, but there's so many things that can go wrong with a physical hack that we were pretty stressed, and you can see we were really happy when we got it open.
That really inspires confidence. Oh, we're sure this is going to work. So tell us a little bit about the robot.
Let me switch to the feed. So we built it out of something called Actobotics, which is basically an erector set. And then we used an Arduino and a really nice motor so that we can move the dials back and forth really fast. So I'm going to start it.
This is a live shot of the robot in your office right now.
Yep.
Oh, look. Yep. Now, you took a shortcut, right? Because you knew something about how these Sentry safes worked.
That's correct. We found a vulnerability. There are three disks inside the safe, and so you have to dial those three disks to get the safe open. Well, we found out that the third disk has a vulnerability that you can exploit from the outside of the safe. So we attach the robot, and within about 20 seconds, the robot takes some measurements and establishes what the last number is of the three-digit combination.
Oh, so it's really only a two-digit combination.
Bingo. Yep.
Wow. And, which exponentially cuts down the number of tries you've got to make. Yeah.
Quite a lot. Yeah. And it worked really well. Then we found some other tricks to it, and we got the crack time down to about it was going to be about an hour and 20 minutes, but we got lucky at the DEF CON talk and got it in, I think it was, like you said, 30 minutes.
Oh, so it could have taken as long as two hours.
An hour and 20 minutes, yep.
Oh, an hour and 20, okay.
And you'd 3D printed the actual turning device onto the on so that it was an exact match with the safe dial, right?
That's correct. We took some measurements of the dial and then printed a 3D coupler so it attaches right to the face of it.
Well, so let's show the robot again, because it was sure. So there's two parts to it. On the left, it's trying it after every attempt at combination, but it looks like it's only doing, what is it? We'll take a look
at it. It's giving a slight tug on the lever.
So it's actually trying to open it, and then yep. That's that handle on the left. I guess it stopped.
It did. I'm going to start it again for you guys.
And did it open it?
Yeah, I'm going to show you what it looks like. When
it actually
does that.
Worked.
It will. Well, it's. I'm not as nervous about this one.
So this is the preliminary bit where it's testing the discs, and now is it doing two different numbers every time?
That's correct. So it just pulled down on the handle, and the handle went far enough.
Yeah,
it opened. Oh, so my want, God.
That was it. If you want, I can pull it off and show you the inside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So does it know the combination here, or this one is just kind of, you'd been running it for a while? Wow, look at that.
Yeah.
That's it.
And this is not like some child's toy safe. This is a serious safe.
This is so it was important to me to show sort of vulnerabilities in a safe that everybody has. This is the most common safe in North America.
Oh,
you can buy it at all the regular sort of home maintenance stores.
Yeah,
this robot won't really work on really high-end expensive safes. It will work. It'll just take days and days and days.
Right. Yeah.
But nobody has those safes. Everybody has one of these safes.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, there's also, you've got the difference between the physical and the digital safe in that, you know, a digital safe will have a certain number of cutouts, and if you try a number of dodgy connections, then it'll just lock the thing down
but
for a
certain
period.
But this is just a mechanical thing.
But this is a mechanical thing, so you can try these things on a multiple basis.
Yeah, it doesn't slow you down after some guesses.
No, I mean, all you need to do is break into someone's house, take about 30 minutes, and see what you get.
Well, that raises an interesting question. How useful would this be for an actual safe cracker?
That's a good question.
I'm just thinking. I might.
Well, I mean, it would be really difficult to explain to the cops if you're caught with an erector sac module.
No, it's a toy for my kid. The cops are going to look at it and say, "Well, that's clearly a robot to crack safes."
There's so many other ways to get a safe open.
That wouldn't, like dynamite.
You wouldn't spend the 45 minutes. A crowbar, you can drop it. You can do all sorts of stuff to it to get it open.
Right.
This is really useful for people. As soon as we created the safe, we had friends that came out of the woodwork that said, oh, my goodness, I have a safe in my basement that's attached to my house that I have no idea what the code is.
Mm. Right.
Can you help me come open the safe? So there's, I think that's where this robot is going to be most useful, is sort of helping those folks.
It does worry me that you're going to kill. I mean, Reddit, as you know, is huge on safes that are being found.
Yeah.
So please don't let Reddit get their hands on this, because it'll kill everyone going, why isn't this open yet?
Too late. Too late. And I'm sure Sentry Safe is going to say, oh, we better
they're
change.
Going to love you for this.
We better change those that. Basically, because it's got a flaw in it that eliminates one number.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not
But this is what DEF CON is about. It's about finding out these flaws, getting them public and exposing them, and that hopefully the manufacturer will now fix this.
When you turn on that safe cracking thing, it's autonomous at that point, right? It's not, there's no human involvement.
That's correct. I've currently got it hooked up to my computer, but if you there was a big red button on it, so you can attach it to the robot, attach the robot to the safe, hit the big red button, and it does its thing.
That was easy. Wow, this is really, really cool. Is there a future? Do you have a name for him?
I don't. I should have named him.
Everybody needs a name. And does he have a future, or is he going to be, you know, taken down to parts?
Oh, no. He's going to stay put together. We like to show off lots of demos at SparkFun.
Nice.
So this
will
be a permanent demo that folks can check out whenever they come take the tour.
So when you started SparkFun, you were a college kid at CU Boulder?
CU Boulder, yep.
That's where my son is. That's awesome. So this was in your dorm room. You started SparkFun.
Mm-hmm. Started shipping stuff out. I thought I would sell some parts to some friends in Boulder, maybe Colorado.
That's
my
so
third
cool.
order was from France.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Wow.
That was how bad things were back then.
And now your catalog includes 2,000 parts and pieces and all of that. And look at all this. I mean, it is a wonderful site. It's fun. It's fun just to go browse and eventually you'll say, oh,
well,
I've got to
have
this.
But it's also dangerous because you're going to like, oh, I'd like that, and I'd kind of like that. And before you know it, you know, it's like you've got a shopping basket full of stuff.
So, a couple of final questions. Did you open that safe your wife gave you?
I did finally, yes.
Was there anything in it?
There wasn't, unfortunately. but it's the Geraldo Rivera moment, right?
Exactly. Al Capone's safe. Nothing.
Al Capone's cork.
No,
they found in there.
And finally, John asks a good question. Does the robot tell you the combination after it opens the safe?
It does. If you're in autonomous mode, you don't care. The safe is open, right? You're just going to get it open and go on. But for demonstrations, whenever we've got a big display that we hook to the top of it.
That's what that display is. Okay. Yep. Yeah, because you would want to know the code so you could use the safe afterwards. Very cool. Hey, I'm so glad you could join us. Congratulations on what was easily the hit of DEF CON, right?
Oh, yes, totally. I mean, it was one of the ones that everyone was talking about in the bars afterwards.
Thank you so much. Yeah. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. Nathan Seidel is the founder of SparkFun Electronics, and I guess he's still kind of a little bit got that maker streak going on.
Yeah,
in there.
It's the maker hacker ethos. It's what makes this industry great.
I love it. I really love it, yeah. Thank you, Nathan.
Cheers, mate.
Take care. And congratulations on the robot. We should have a contest to name the robot. I can't believe he didn't name the robot. Name him Marmite. Marmite the safe cracking robot.
It's not a great superhero name, but we'll see.
But it's not. Mighty Mite. Sentry Mite. I don't know. There's got to be a name for them.
Cracky McCrackface.
Cracky McCrackface. Oh,
don't get the internet started like that.
I like it. Cracky McCrackface. Get ready for a cleanse. Not your colon. No coffee involved. Megan Maroney is going to do the first in her endless series, well, it's at least 10 parts, of her digital cleanse. We're going to start off with notifications. Watch.
Have you ever done a cleanse? You know, one of those detox diets where you juice a bunch of nutritious fruits and vegetables and you also give up sugar and coffee. And if you're really serious and insane, you also give up wine. It's supposed to clean out your system so you live your best life or some such garbage. To each his own, but I'm not into it. However, I have begun to feel that my technological life could use a little detoxing. I'd like to clean up all my useless notifications and excess email and photos in the cloud and cables and digital subscriptions and all the other tech stuff that's clogging my pipes, as it were. So I've decided to embark on a 10-week adventure that I'm calling a digital cleanse. Hashtag digital cleanse. And I want you to join me. I'm not talking about giving up your screens or cutting back on your Twitter time. That's just crazy talk. I'm talking about deleting all your duplicate photos, tidying up your cloud storage accounts, or at long last, finding a place for all those dongles. Each week on the new Screensavers, we will conquer one part of our digital life that needs a detox. It won't be complicated. It won't involve Linux or rooting or jailbreaking. And it won't involve kale smoothies. But it will require a commitment on your part. And I want some feedback from you, if you're willing to give it. Did anything change after you completed the weekly task? Send me screenshots of your tidy desktops and empty inboxes. You can use my email, megan@twit.tv, or you can post on Twitter. I'm @MeganMaroney, and use the hashtag #DigitalCleanse. Sound like a deal? Good. Let's get started. Week one, we're going to start with what I believe to be one of the most toxic parts of tech, iPhone notifications. A study from Florida State says that notifications are distracting and disruptive to whatever we're doing, even if we ignore the notification. Just the act of hearing that ping or feeling the vibration in our pocket or on our wrist will pull us from the task at hand and make it harder to focus again. Notifications are a little different in the iOS 11 beta. I'm going to assume that you're still using iOS 10. And if you're using an Android phone, I recommend checking out Android App Arena episode number 134, where Jason Howell shows you how to manage your notifications on Android. The best way to start digitally cleansing your notifications on the iPhone is app by app. Go to Settings, then Notifications. For most apps, you're going to want to turn off notifications altogether. You probably never meant to turn them on in the first place, and you do not need them as much as you need to focus on work or family or friends or Game of Thrones. Just do it. you will thank me later. Of course, there will be a few apps that you will still want notifications for. Then you get to decide if you want to hear a sound or have them show in the notification center or the lock screen or all three. If you use your notification center as a to-do list, great. If you don't, I can't see any reason to leave notification center alerts on for any app. And for goodness sake, everyone, please turn off badge app icon notifications for all of your apps, especially your email apps. No one needs to see how many unread emails they have. That is toxic. Your final step is to choose the alert style. The cleanliest of all digital cleansers would choose none. Again, if you use notifications as a to-do list, then you might want to choose the alerts style. That means the alert will require action before you proceed. Next, I want you to turn off notifications at night by using the Do Not Disturb feature. Go to Settings, Do Not Disturb, and then choose a time. I recommend at least an 8-hour nighttime reprieve from notifications, but if most of your notifications come from work and you can afford to shut off after 7 p.m., why not start then? You could also turn on Do Not Disturb during your regular dinner time or other times you need to focus. But what if there's an emergency, you might ask? As long as your kids or your parents or your partner or your best friend are in your favorites list, you can make sure to allow calls from your favorites, even if you have Do Not Disturb turned on. And let's all agree together that if we need to contact someone in an emergency, we will call them right back if they don't answer the first time. And as long as you turn on repeated calls, a call from the same person within 3 minutes will not be silenced. You can also choose to silence your phone always or only when your phone is locked. I recommend always. Now that you have your iPhone sorted, it's time to make sure all your watch notifications mirror your iPhone. Or better yet, you might even want fewer notifications on your Apple Watch than your iPhone. And if you don't find the reminders to breathe or to stand helpful, just turn those off. And some days, especially when you're on vacation, you might not want to be bothered by your watch at all. You could leave it at home, or you could turn on Do Not Disturb by sliding up the notification center and tapping the moon icon. Or you could try the nuclear option and turn your watch on power reserve so that it only shows you the time. To do that, tap on the battery notification icon and then slide over for power reserve. That is your digital cleanse for the week. Let me know how you did. Send me your screenshots to megan@twit.tv or post them on Twitter with the hashtag #digitalcleanse. And come back next week for tips on Inbox Zero. Until then, I hope that ridding your technology life of all the digital pollutants will help you live and work more mindfully and more efficiently. No carrot juice required. I'm Megan Maroney, and I host iOS Today every Tuesday at 9 a.m. Pacific, and I host Tech News Today with Jason Howell every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific.
Thank you, Megan Maroney. I'm looking forward to this. We got a whole bunch of more tips coming every week, a new digital cleanse.
I think it is important that you actually take control of your devices and don't have them nagging you the whole time. I know app developers love it when because it gets...
Did you just have some Marmite? You just had some Marmite, didn't you?
Just a little bit. It was there. I couldn't resist it.
No, they have to they have to ping you all the time, don't they? It drives me crazy.
Well, they don't have to, but, I mean, they feel that they have to, and it's so annoying.
I have to say, I think that computer users, technology users, and I guess smartphone users now, everybody, there's, in every one of these devices, there's something that just annoys you. It's just, it's a, I think what you Brits would call a niggling, niggling feature that just, you can't, but usually it's minor enough that you put up with it, and I call this death by a thousand paper cuts, because you just, bit by bit, they add up, and pretty soon, it's not a happy experience. My philosophy is, if something bothers you, to fix it, and fix it right then and there, or work on it, because otherwise it will bother you, and it'll continue to bother you, and eventually you just kind of tune it out. But I think it slowly shuts you down. Pretty soon you're just like, I'm not paying any attention to any of that stuff.
I used to get this with my Android phone, where if I went somewhere with a location turned on, like a bar or a restaurant, it would say, oh, perhaps you'd like to review this bar or restaurant.
Yeah, Foursquare.
You're like, no, I really don't.
Yeah,
go
Google
away.
Does it too. Maybe you want to take a picture. You could take a picture. But I'd love it if you took a picture.
Exactly. But it got me so frustrated that I was just like, right, I'll fix it. I'll turn it off. And in 15 minutes' work, I turned off something which was making me want to punch
That's
the phone
point.
Every day.
A lot of times we say, well, I don't have 15 minutes to fix this little thing. But if you add up all those little annoyances, it's worth it.
It really ruins your day.
It ruins your day. Hey, let's do a call for help. What do you say, Ian?
Definitely.
Here we go. Mark from Albany left this question for us.
How do Ian and Leo? This is Mark. I've got a question on security updates. Specifically, I have the Nexus 6 that I actually bought through Verizon Wireless. And I know from Google I should be getting those security updates guaranteed through October of this year. If I were to pull up my security settings, you'd actually see that I have security updates through April of this year. So I've been a number of months behind. I've done all the steps that I know to do, all the steps that Verizon suggests, clearing cache, double-checking the updates, and as far as Verizon's concerned, I have the most current build for my particular phone. But I know if I go to the website for Google factory images, I actually have updates available to me through July at this point in time, and actually August should be right around the corner for me. But I know that I'm not seeing those updates. A little more investigation, I found out that my operating system is actually behind. Verizon has 7.0.0. And Google Images, I can get 7.1.1. I found it kind of interesting that my security updates were artificially limited from Verizon Wireless in this case. I can go through the process and update my cell phone on my own, but I was wondering if you guys had any other suggestions or feedback that we might be able to utilize. Thank you very much. I want to let you guys know what a great job you're doing. Thank you.
Oh, it's very good of you.
Mark from Albany. So there are two kinds of updates that you get on Android. There are the updates he was talking about, 7.0 to 7.1.
Right. The main operating system updates.
To 1. And those are mostly feature updates.
Yeah.
Google has, just like Microsoft does now, segregated the security updates into a monthly security patch. That's the one you absolutely have to have. It's okay. I don't think it's the end of the world if you're at 7.0. That's mostly just, you know, features are going to look a little different.
Yeah, they changed the icon slightly in that sort of thing. But you're right. The security patches are what you've absolutely got to be religious about.
And that may be what you're not getting. I'm not saying that Verizon's pushing that. Because if you think about it, these kinds of patches have a number of stages they have to go through. First of all, Google in its, you know, research, or maybe somebody tells it, finds a flaw. They figure out how to fix it, and they push it to the Android repositories because Android is open source.
Yep.
And then they roll it up as an update, which they then don't do. They will on your Pixel phone, perhaps, because they make it the Pixel phone. Mm-hmm. But what they'll do is they'll send that to then the handset manufacturer, because many handset manufacturers, like Samsung, LG, HTC, modify the operating system significantly, so they're going to want to test that patch and see if it breaks the modified operating system. And if it doesn't, then they say, okay, let's push this patch out. But there's another stage it has to go through. Your carrier.
Yes.
Verizon, in your case, Big Red, but AT&T, T-Mobile, Sprint, U.S. Cellular, whoever your carrier is, in the U.K., you know, 3 or whoever, they have to then test it because they've done some things to your phone as well. They also have another burden. They're the ones who have to spend the bandwidth.
Exactly. And that, I think, is where the choke comes in.
I agree.
In that the telcos are not prepared. I mean, when Google first came out with the monthly updates, a lot of the manufacturers were kind of like, well, we'll get it out when we get there. And after a year of this, Google was just like, right, you need to get this out fast. And a lot of the manufacturers have been great on it. But it's the telcos. Those are the people who seem to be holding it up.
They're the gatekeepers.
Yeah.
There are rules about who pays for the bandwidth. And I'm trying to remember what the rule is.
I think it's the telco, but...
Well, not always. I think a feature update... The telco pays for.
Oh, but a security update.
Ooh,
that's grim.
Google would pay for. The manufacturer will pay for.
Right.
But that's another factor involved: is who's going to pay the bill? And as you might imagine, if you sold 10 million phones, you're pushing out 100 megabyte or 200 megabyte update to each of them. It does add up. It's not cheap. So these are all considerations, and it's one of the reasons you just don't get those updates all the time. Again, Verizon, I think, would pay for the update from 7.0 to 7.1. Mm-hmm. That's why, or maybe it's Samsung. I don't know. Anyway, it's not uncommon. I have a Samsung Galaxy S8 that is at 7.0.
Yeah, like I've got a 6P, a Nexus 6P myself, which is up at the most.
7.0.
And the change is
I don't think it's
minuscule.
A big deal.
No,
I'm at 7.1.2 with my Google Pixel, because that's a Google phone that has the most recent updates.
Indeed.
But the key is they just, for instance, 2 days ago pushed out the August security patch. Usually it's about a week in to the month, maybe two, mm-hmm. where that patch comes out, that's the one you want to get.
Yeah.
They've asked manufacturers, as you said, to pledge. And in mm-hmm. some cases, manufacturers have pledged to push those patches.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Samsung used to be lousy at this, and now they've really picked up their game.
I would only buy an Android phone from a company that says, no, no, we will push out those monthly
patches. Exactly.
And similarly, if you're not getting them from a carrier, I would stop using that carrier. It's very important you get these security patches. He mentions Broadpone, which is a really scary flaw.
Oh, yes.
10 million Android phones would be... a billion.
No, it's a billion Android phones. Could be turned into the biggest botnet we've seen.
But fortunately, before... this was publicized.
Responsible disclosure, they got the patch out. But if you haven't got the patch, you really, really need it.
And I would guess that many of those billion phones are still vulnerable because they're older phones
on colossal
KitKat or Gingerbread on old versions of Android. They're just not getting updated. So this is a severe issue on Android.
Yes.
It's why, frankly, I recommend Google's Android phones only.
Exactly.
You get the updates. They're actually very good. They're not very stylish.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Pixel, they bumped... the old Nexus phones, I recommended unreservedly. The Pixel, they bumped the price up quite considerably.
It's too expensive.
And it's only got a three-year lifespan. They're only going to support it for 3 years.
But what would you recommend in its place? A Samsung? An LG? They're great phones out there, but...
I know.
Security is going to have to take pride of place.
If you buy from Google, you get the security updates fastest, you get the software updates fastest.
Right.
And I think they know this, which is why they've jacked up the price and reduced the lifespan of it, which is pretty shameless when you think about it.
One thing Google is, because Google knows this is a problem, one thing that Google is doing to address this is they're moving more and more of the operating system out of the base operating system and into the Play Store. So that's why you probably notice, for instance, Google Play Services now is actually in the store and gets updated by the store. Mm-hmm. That means Google can push that update. Regardless of what the carriers and the manufacturers say.
Yeah.
So more and more of Android is getting updated in the store. That's a good thing. They also announced this week something they call Android Play Protect. And I think some of this is PR, because look at the page.
Yeah.
Peace of mind in the palm of your hand. Introducing Google Play Protect. One less worry for over a billion users. Backed by the strength of Google. What this, I think, is... they call it a security blanket for your mobile device.
I'm waiting to see what kind of a data hog this is going to be, because I suspect it's going to be fairly heavy on the old data flows.
I think it's merely a step up on what they've already been doing. You know, everything that... anytime you install an app, it gets scanned by your phone. That's actually pretty good.
And it's a great way to feed data into their, you know, into their bouncer.
Oh, God, you're so cynical.
I'm a journalist. It comes with a job.
You're so cynical. What they're doing now is applying the same kind of scanning behavior that you get every time you install an app to your phone on a regular basis. So it's actively looking for known flaws in your phone. Okay, you're the cynic. I'm going to be the Pollyanna here.
I prefer to think of myself as a realist who hasn't been proved right yet.
This is Google saying, look, we got a problem here. We got a lot of Android phones out there, and we really can't force the carriers and manufacturers to update them. We're going to have to take it on ourselves to do a better job. And I think this is what that is. So I think I go back and forth. A lot of, you tell me, because you know these security boffins.
Yeah.
Many of them are saying, I'll never use an Android phone. I only use an iPhone because I feel more safe about it. I'm not convinced. I mean, this is such a black box, the iPhone.
Yeah.
Only Apple can really tell you whether they're keeping it secure or not.
And
they
do
push updates, but you have to trust Apple.
Yeah.
Google does all the right things to make Android phones more updatable, would you trust Android?
I've never owned an iPhone. I've always trusted Android.
See?
And the reason is I prefer open source software, and B, I like to own my product and not, you know, ask permission for Apple to use it. But it does raise a very good point. Apple security was clearly superior to Android's for a while. The main problem with Android is updating. And this comes back to the central question that we were asked in the first place. There are so many different... very few people have the latest Android operating system.
Right.
There's an enormous long tail of, you know, we've got an Android 2.2 phone in the office, and that's never going to be updated.
No.
You know, it was just... so, you know, what they need to do is sort out their updating policy, because with iOS, everyone updates. When there's a new version of the operating system out, generally within a month or so, 80, 90% of iOS users are updated. That isn't the case with Android.
Right.
And while I applaud Android's, you know, Google's moves on Android this week, they've really got to solve the fracturing of the operating system, because I think that's the real security weakness.
It's because it's open source. You can't have it both ways.
Nope.
Once you take a phone operating system and you say anybody can install it on any phone they want, you're giving up control.
Yeah.
And so I understand that Google, you know, was philosophically in favor of open source, mm-hmm. but that means they lost control of the operating system.
And that's so
ultimately, that's a hard thing for them to solve. I don't know what the right answer is. I use both an iPhone and an Android phone. Here's the real question. Would you take either of them to DEF CON? Absolutely not.
Actually, no. I did take my phone to DEF CON, but I stripped out a bunch of stuff on it beforehand, and it got a factory reset the day after I arrived back home.
Nokia Candy Bar phone. I'd get a 3310 and bring that to DEF CON.
No, I mean, I take basically any hardware I take to DEF CON gets a factory reset the day
that's
after I come
idea.
Back.
And hope
all
that
passwords
works.
Get changed.
Yeah, that's, well, there you go. Hey, you want to do another one?
Yeah, why not?
Let's do another call for help.
Hi, guys. I've been following Steve's Trust No One, and I've been looking into a cloud solution. And I've come across Mega.nz. My question is, what you guys input? Is it truly Trust No One?
Oh, wow.
Let
me add some footnotes. When he says Steve, he's talking about Steve Gibson.
Yeah.
And Steve Gibson has this phrase he uses, which I love, called trust no one. That means nothing on the internet is trustworthy unless it's encrypted with strong encryption, mm-hmm. and no one but you has the key.
Exactly.
That's trust no one. So Dropbox, not trust no one. It's encrypted, mm-hmm. but they have the key. Apple's iCloud, not trust no one. They have the key. You're looking for a solution that's encrypted before it reaches the internet, encrypted on the way and encrypted in place, and no one else has the key. That's a trust no one solution. Mega.nz is an interesting company. This was created by Kim.com.
The Portly Pirates, yes.
Why do you call him the Portly Pirate?
Well, because he massively enabled piracy, and he's slightly on the larger side.
But he's quite a character. In fact, if you read up on Kim.com.
Well, what worries me about Mega is that he is under highly targeted attack by both the US and New Zealand governments. Now, the rights or wrongs of that, you could argue it either way, because he's a complex character. But at the same time, I'm not sure I would trust my data to the service, primarily because it could get taken down at any time if the authorities get their way. I don't know enough about
Only you hold the key. I mean, and technically, I think it would be a trust no one service.
But I've seen no one trying to break this. What you need is people actually going in and trying to break through these systems. And I haven't seen enough pen testing about the services yet. There are services out there that can do it. I know you and I both have our favorites on this score, but
We'll talk about that. We suggest as an alternative in just a second. I would say read the privacy policy, which I have, and it does say that they collect information about you. They'll hand over information, including information about mm-hmm. what kinds of things you're doing on Mega to law enforcement if required. Now, read this one, user installed encryption. What you're looking for is strong open source encryption, RSA.
Yes.
You're not looking for a roll your own solution.
No, you can never trust a closed encryption solution.
What I don't see here is what they're doing for encryption. They do say that you're doing the encryption and it's happening in your web browser.
But they don't say who's.
They don't say what they're doing.
Yeah, where they actually got it from in the first place.
That makes me nervous. So the reputation of the site as a file sharing site, the potential of them being taken down. In fact, I'm surprised they're still around. I guess they were getting a lot of heat for a while. Is a potential problem, not having to do with security. They haven't really identified what encryption they're using. Mm. There's no reason for them not to use well-known strong encryption, because it's out there, but they should say it.
Yeah.
They should say it. And the fact that they don't makes me nervous. Now, here are some solutions you can use that are truly trust no one and use strong, well-known encryption technologies. Go ahead, show them yours, and I'll show them mine.
I go with SpiderRogue.
That's Edward Snowden's favorite.
Yes, this is Edward Snowden's favorite.
That's a strong recommendation.
Favorite cloud storage. You encrypt the data yourself. Only you hold the keys. That data can't be read by a Patriot Act order or by a national security letter. You are in reasonable control as you can be. And bear in mind, at the end of the day, if the NSA or another state-sponsored hacking group wants to get your data, they will get it. They will just
what they often could do is get it in transit or get it on your machine. Get it
exactly.
In place.
Yeah.
And so if you have a solution, I mean, you could even roll your own with Dropbox, where mm-hmm. you have the data on your machine, you use something to encrypt it, mini lock or some sort of RSA strong mm-hmm. encryption.
Yep.
In place, and then you upload it to Dropbox. That's going to be safe. Only you have access to it. But the NSA, remember that maybe they have something on your machine that's watching what you're doing.
Oh yeah. If that level of a target, you can forget about security. Yeah.
Nobody's fully safe. If they want. So I
you
think
have your favorite as well.
This is one I just recently discovered. Somebody called the radio show said, "What do you think about it?" And I'll tell you why I might prefer to Spider Oak. Spider Oak is based in the U.S.
That is the big downside.
So their servers are susceptible to subpoena. Again, if it's Trust No One, fine. All they're going to get is an encrypted blob.
Yeah, but.
This one's in Switzerland. It's called Treasure It or Trezor It, T-R-E-S-O-R-I-T. It's a paid service. I think it really is elegant. It runs on Windows, Mac, and Linux, which I really appreciate. They have mm-hmm. a Linux client. It's end-to-end encrypted file sharing. I find it very useful. One of the features I really like, most of these services are like Dropbox where you have or OneDrive or right. even iCloud. They have a single kind of folder, Dropbox
yeah.
folder.
Just drag and drop it in.
Yeah. And that's what's getting synced. This allows you to have any folder arbitrarily be synced. It's kind of more like BitTorrent sync in that respect.
Interesting.
And I find that great. They call them Trezors. You can create as many as you want. You can share it, and people get a browser link. They don't have mm-hmm. to make an account. So it's good for file sharing. And it is truly Trust No One using strong open source encryption. So it meets, in my opinion, all of the criteria. It's in Switzerland.
Yeah, the Swiss thing is really important because Switzerland has very good data security laws. It's one of the gold standards, if you like, of countries' data security. This is why when, you remember the Black Phone?
Yeah.
That's where their servers were based.
That's
because,
right.
Because, you know, they were, if you're going to, you know, be running a secure
open,
mobile.
Open signal systems
yeah,
that, right?
That's yeah. right. Yeah. So a lot of companies now are, I mean, and Switzerland, let's face it, you know, they own all the money, it's the most defensible country in the world. They're pretty much, they make their own rules to an extent. But right. on data security, they're really, really good.
So there's two good ones. I think both would be fine. Spider Oak and Treasure It. You should probably figure out. I think both have a free tier of a few gigabytes.
Yeah.
You should figure out which one you like. There are probably many other ways to do this. Steve Gibson mentioned Dropbox has a new one-shot use encrypted solution. Mm-hmm. There are probably a lot of ways out there. But remember, nothing is fully secure if you're a target and your hardware can be compromised.
If your endpoint is compromised, that's game right. over. That's and the whole ballgame.
You should always make sure that the transit is safe. And a man-in-the-middle attack on data going across. Because remember, these law enforcement agencies often try to get data before it hits the endpoint.
Indeed.
In transit, and that's always a risk as well. But I think you should feel safe with Treasure It or
yeah.
Spider.
Yeah,
Spider.
I think so. I mean, both good chances. Yeah.
Somebody's mentioning he uses local cloud storage, personal cloud storage. I use Synology, and I do put stuff on that. That's another case of, you know, you have to trust that Synology software doesn't have a hole in it. It's fairly complex. That it's not easily broken into or attackable.
Yeah.
I would reduce, if you're using Synology, reduce your attack surfaces. Don't turn on FTP or SFTP or SSH unless you know you need it. But turn on as few services as possible. You can run Apache and PHP.
It's all about minimizing that target area and making sure there's so few places that somebody can get in.
Right, right. I actually have accounts on almost all of these services, including Spider Oak. And I probably should shut this down. This is another one of my digital cleanse should be turn off services that you subscribed to 12 years ago and are still paying for, even though you never use it. Hey, thanks for the calls. Mark in Albany and Jose in Modesto. Great to have both of you. Next week, Scott Bourne's going to be standing right there. Haven't seen Scott in person since he did Mac Break Weekly maybe 10 years ago. He's now an avid bird photographer, very famous wildlife photographer, an Olympus ambassador. He's switched from those big Nikon and Canon systems he used to use to the Micro Four Thirds Olympus OMD, and he loves it. And man, does he get great pictures. If you've got a question for Scott Bourne on Macs, on iPhones, or on photography, this is how you can get a hold of him.
Need tech help? The new screensavers are here with answers. Email your tech questions to newscreensavers@twit.tv.
I'd love to get you on with Scott next week. The mailbag's coming up next, but first, Our audiophile resident musician, Jason Howell. He's yellow gold.
He does take it seriously.
He takes it very seriously. In fact, whenever we get any audio stuff to review, we send it to him. We've got a new set of studio monitors, micro studio monitors, from IK Multimedia. It's the iLoud. He has this review.
I'm here with IK Multimedia's newest kind of compact speaker system, more meant for studio monitoring for musicians. It's called the iLoud Micro Monitors, and you can see they're really a nice, small, tight package, although when you pick them up, they've got a nice amount of heaviness, not ultra heavy. These are going to fit really nicely into your suitcase, your luggage. It's kind of meant more to be like a mobile production speaker setup. And they're really nice. The $300 for the pair, as you can see right here. IK Multimedia calls these the smallest active studio reference monitoring system in the world. But don't let the size fool you. They've got some really good sound. As you can see, small and compact, has 50 watts of total RMS power in these speakers, four amplifiers inside, 3/4 inch silk dome tweeters, 3 inch woofers on the front with a front firing port for bass travel. This is what really actually gets a lot more bass out of these tiny speakers than you would expect. Inputs on the back, like I said, this is meant for kind of travel. So you're not going to get your XLR input, which I would like to have. I realize it would probably change the size of this. But you have your RCA input. You've got your 1/8 inch headphone. So you can plug it into your laptop. If you've got a mobile rig with your laptop, you can just pack these along and do that. It also has the capability to bring in Bluetooth, so you can connect it to your phone to preview tracks and that sort of thing. And then DSP on board to help you model the sound around the space that you happen to be in. As you can see here, whether it's mounted on a mic stand flat or on a desk, you can kind of change the DSP to match the scenario. Also, you can reduce 3 decibels of high frequency and low frequency feedback there as well. And as you can see underneath, you have the little mounting spot. So I could screw this onto any speaker mounting system and have it be out there. Or if I set it on a desk, I've got this like retractable little stand here that points it up at me, which actually was really handy. I had these sitting next to my main studio speakers at my home, which are the Mackie HR824s, a lot bigger reference monitors. So I got to kind of compare between the two, and the sound, surprising low end considering their size, down to 55 hertz thanks to the 56-bit DSP inside. I would say definitely emphasized on the mid-range. These are more, you're probably going to get the most clarity out of the mid-range frequencies and content that's in there. I used it more as a way to kind of get a sense of what's happening in the mid-range in my mixes while I was using it. I felt that was as strong a suit. Highest sounded, I'd say, a bit flat, not hyped up, which I think is actually a good thing. You didn't get that brittle quality. It sounded like it was a little bit more natural. And of course, great stereo separation. Although I did notice that when I pushed them hard, when you push it hard, this little LED on the front starts to light up and starts to kind of give you a little bit of red feedback. You don't want to go up there. The sound would kind of tighten up a little bit. It would clamp down. That red overdrive light comes on at least to let you know. But I found that at the top end of the volume that I was getting out of these was about as loud as I ever really wanted them anyways. I don't blast it when I'm doing my production at home. Overall, I had a lot of fun playing around with the IK Multimedia iLoud micro monitors. As you see here, I fully intend on using them some more to get a little bit more clarity and a little bit more information out of my mid-range instruments on the material that I'm working on. So definitely check them out. $300, you can get yourself a pair and take them on the road. I'm Jason Howell. Find me all over the Twit Network with Tech News Today and All About Android.
See, I think there's a market. There's going to be a market for powered, relatively small and expensive powered speakers, because, you know, Amazon has announced
right
that the Echo, the Amazon Web Voice Services, is going to start doing what Sonos does, which is allow you to have multiple echoes playing the same song. You can even have party mode where they all play the same song, or you can have living room, kitchen playing one song, bedroom, master bath playing another song.
It's a logical extension for the platform.
But it's huge because Sonos keeps promising they're going to add voice. They haven't. Mm-hmm. Many people, myself included, have spent a lot of money on Sonos systems because we like that idea of having, you know, speakers in every room, and they're very good sounding. But boy, if those speakers sound as good as Sonos speakers, they're $300. Add a $40 Echo Dot, put them in a few rooms. That's actually a better setup.
It's such a more flexible setup, certainly.
Yeah. And it's really,
this is where that technology is going. If you're going to have one of these things in the house, you may as well expand it around and give yourself some more choice.
I'm looking forward to that. And Sonos, hurry! Get your voice support, especially your Echo
support.
Much?
It's what I don't understand why Sonos is being so slow about this.
Well, they're going to lose their business.
I know. Sooner or later, it's going to drive them out of business.
You've got Apple coming at you in December with the Home Hub.
Yeah.
That's going to apparently sound very good.
Yeah, and also Apple is opening up slightly on its operating system in terms of connecting other devices in there. It's taken out the hardware requirement. Now it's just a software requirement to work
for HomeKit. Yeah. That was very good news. You used to have a proprietary HomeKit chip.
I mean, which was typical Apple at the end of the day, but actually getting rid of that chip requirement,
huge.
Fantastic
huge.
News.
Stacey Higginbotham was very excited on Twig about that, because that means we'll see more HomeKit-enabled devices.
Yes, exactly.
You could add in software.
I mean, I know Apple likes to own the whole ecosystem, but on something like this, it wasn't going to be possible.
Right.
It's kind of like when the iPhone came out, you couldn't have third-party apps on it, and then 18 months later, they went, well, actually, that's a good idea, and now it's a multi-billion-dollar business for them.
Yeah, sure is. It's mailbag time.
Well,
let's see what's in the mailbag box today. I love it that this rolls in. You know, we need to get an autonomous robot that can steer this thing around. I'm just thinking out loud. Oh, the Marmite is there. You can't get away from the Marmite. There's Marmite everywhere in our studio.
Now,
I blame you, Ian Thompson.
Oh, it's the food of the gods.
What else is in here? There's something else in here. What is this? This looks
Good
like
grief.
This looks like something Alex Gumpel probably bought at auction. The HyperCard Script Language Guide. And then look at this.
Signed, no less.
Signed by Bill Atkinson, HyperCard, because this is the 30th anniversary today of the release of HyperCard. August 11th. 30 years. Can we try to get Bill Atkinson on the show next week and talk about HyperCard? Did you ever use HyperCard?
Yes, I did. And just looking at the image of that window now is just like...
Well, it looks so bad, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, it does. But at the same time, you know, we've both been in the industry a long time. And it's kind of like nostalgia. It was simpler in those days.
We've come a long way. You know what? I far prefer these days.
Yeah. Oh, yes, certainly. But at the same time...
But I would love something like HyperCard that was as easy to author multimedia stacks and things like that.
Things are better now, but at the same time, I still miss DOS 5. You know,
this is kind of cool. Anthony's showing us the archives, the Internet archives, have actually put HyperCard, the whole Macintosh, an emulator online, with HyperCard in it. So you can say, I want to run a 128K Mac Classic with Mac Write, Mac Paint, and HyperCard on it. So if you're nostalgic about HyperCard and those screens, boy, that looks primitive.
It does, doesn't it?
Look, you had to have two floppies.
But you remember when this was the mutts nuts. I mean, this was cutting edge stuff.
Never mind. Don't repeat that. Oh, man, I went to... So, 1984, the Mac comes out. Mm. I really wanted one. It was January 1984, but it was $2,500.
I couldn't afford it.
Finally, I couldn't take it at March of that year. I went down to Macy's. Mm-hmm. There used to be a thing called department stores. I went down to Macy's with my Macy's card in hand, and I bought a original Mac for $2,500. It took me years to pay that off.
Great.
But I wanted that thing so bad.
Yeah.
It was very primitive.
Hindsight. No, I mean, I worked odd jobs for like 12 weekends, pulling film off, film proofs off from magazine publishing rolls just to get my first 286. And it was just, you know, kids today, they go down and buy this stuff for nothing. It's just.
We got our 14-year-old, he's starting high school in the fall, and he worked very hard all summer. He didn't have a summer, he had summer school. So I thought, he deserves more. He's been using my old Mac cheese grater running Windows as his gaming rig.
Right.
This poor kid. And I mean, it really, it's an 8-year-old machine or something.
I was going to say, he's going to be getting sniped by it for just like...
I know. So I finally broke down and I bought him one of the Asus Republic of Gaming ROG desktops. It's a very nice... Yeah, it's little, but it's very nice. It has a 1080 in it, NVIDIA 1080. And he's looking at playing this game. So I said, does it look different? He says, yeah, it's HD. So I think he earned it. And that's kind of a fun thing to do, to be able to get a nice gaming system for your kid every once in a while. Pick a card.
I'll take that one.
All right. Our mailbag entries for this week. You start.
Aha. I have email number one. Right. Okay. I've been contacted by a tech support guy from EasySoft LLC.
Oh, dear.
It looks legit, but he wants to offer me 5 years of support for just the simple price of $1,000. He called me out of the blue. Have you ever heard of anything like this? And do I need this kind of support as a private user?
Let's ask the chat room. What do you think?
it's a very simple answer. No. You do not need this kind of support
now,
for $1,000.
If you bought, for instance, a Dell computer,
yeah,
and Dell offers paid support, mm-hmm, and you really think that you're going to want somebody to help you, that's different.
Yes, certainly.
Then I think paying for gold support from Dell or some other company. When I bought my Lenovo laptop that I'm using over there, I decided to splurge a little bit and buy three-year on-site 24-hour replacement.
Right.
That's the kind of thing. You know what you're paying for. It's not $1,000. I think it was $180.
No, but it's a key system, and you've got that kind of peace of mind.
Cory Doctorow said this is what he does. Once a year, he buys himself a new Lenovo, mm-hmm, and he buys the on-site support because he writes. That's his work product, right? So that's one thing. But out of the blue, somebody cold calling you, what do you think?
No, I mean, any tech support that cold calls you out of the blue is either trying to scam you completely, or is, you know, between installing malware onto your own system, or is desperately trying to sell an overpriced service.
Wait a minute. Okay. Look at this is the EasySoft webpage. Now, I don't know anything about EasySoft, but on the paragraph on the right, what people says. No. What people. Okay. What is a red flag? What is the red flag that you, when you see email from somebody, when you see ungrammatical sentences, misspellings?
Yeah.
That's a very bad sign.
No, that is a big...
I don't know anything about them, but that would be enough to say, maybe not $1,000.
No, I mean, that is a red flag painted scarlet jumping up and down going red flag, red flag, red flag.
Red flag, red flag. Now, another point to be made. 5 years? Are you going to have your computer for 5 years?
Yeah.
Don't pay for 5 years of support. That's nuts.
No. But also, I mean, what kind of support are they going to give? Are they going to need to have full access to your computer remotely in order to install these updates?
And I bet they will, and that's very worrisome. I'm sure that one of their services includes remote access.
Exactly.
Updates.
And then you're giving up the whole ballgame, just like that.
Yeah. So even if they're good now, someday down the road, somebody gets a hold of them and says, hey, you know, you could be installing Superfish with every visit and make a little extra money. There's no guarantee they won't do that. So I think that's not a good idea. Get support from the company that made your computer.
Exactly.
Pay for the upgraded support if you want.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that, customer support has really been unbundled from PCs today. Yep. That was one of the ways they got the price down. They don't give you very good support for free.
No, that's true. But at the same time, 90% of users don't really need that kind of in-depth technical support.
Yeah, I don't mind.
And if you've got a few tech savvy skills and you think you've got a problem, then just wipe and reload your operating system. Yeah. It's not rocket science.
It's tough, though. I understand his question because, where else do you go? Where do you get?
Yeah.
Is there somebody in my neighborhood who could come over and clean viruses off my computer? Where do I go? And it's hard to know what the answer is.
I mean, a good local PC shop actually is still a real boon if you've got
the
community. Well,
if they've been there a long time.
Yeah, I mean, if they've been doing it for 10, 15 years.
There's a guy named Bubba in a T-shirt in the back. Hasn't seen the sun for 12 years. That sounds like a good sign.
But yeah, I mean, honestly, extended warranties is where a lot of manufacturers make their money these days.
Yeah.
And yes.
I'm not a fan.
No,
I'm not a fan.
I'm not
saying buy an extended warranty. I'm saying
but a support
buy
warranty.
Extended support.
Yes,
that's
that is a better buy.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyone who calls you up out of the blue, that's an instant
that
red flag
bad.
As well.
And grammatical errors on the front page of the website of the company.
Although I'm still waiting for one of these tech support scammers to call me up and tell me I've got a virus, because I want to keep this guy on the line for hours. Just like, really? So hang on, I pushed this button. No.
You know what? I used to do that kind of thing. Now what I do is I just humiliate him. I say, does your mother know that you are scamming people? And they always hang up. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm working for my mother right now.
Well, somebody
did. It was her idea.
There was an interesting hack where somebody DDoSed the they found a VoIP app and they called them up and just played this message saying you are a terrible person.
Tempting. That's highly illegal. I don't recommend it.
Of course, I would never recommend it.
I understand it's tempting, but you know these poor people. They're probably being paid.
They prey on people that don't know a lot about computers, and I think that's scum.
That is bad. You're right. I can't give them a break. Question number two from James. You said on past shows not to open email attachments. Yeah. How is it possible to do that? I own a small business. My customers send me POs, purchase orders, by email. My employees and I need to open. What do I do? That is a very difficult one.
It is.
But really, what I generally say is do not send attachments and do not open them. The reason is that that is still, even to this day, the number one vector for malware, very common for ransomware to come in as an email attachment.
Yes.
I've seen sometimes in the mainstream media, they say, don't open attachments for somebody you don't know. No, it's somebody you know. That's the worst thing. It's your boss. It's your coworker. It's your mother. It's your friend, because they've been hacked.
And then it spreads
out. And it gets sent to you. Yeah. So you can't trust who it's from. If you do business this way, I mean, ideally as a business, I wouldn't send attachments. I would send links to a service that we like treasure it.
Indeed.
Or something like that where you're not, at least not sending a file. And that's helpful, although, of course, a link can still be troubling.
Yes, if it's goes to a malware load. So I have the same problem. I mean, I get press releases saying, this new malware is spreading via attachment. Read our press release in the attachment below. And you're like, this is just dumb. You know, it boggles belief.
Don't attach text files. Put it in the email. Send, if you need to send an attachment, the best way to do it is to call ahead. Say, I'm sending an attachment. It will be via a link, not an attached file in the email.
And when in doubt, check with the original. That's the key. Simple phone call. Just say, did you send me an attachment?
Did you send me a PO?
Because this looks slightly dodgy.
Yeah.
And, you know, they can confirm or deny. But, yeah, we should be sending this in plain text by now.
I think if customers are sending you POs by email, and they're sending them in PDFs, they're sending them in Word documents, both of those could affect you.
Very easily.
Then you should probably call before you open it and say, hey, look, I got your PO. Did you just send me a PO? Yeah. Okay, good. I was just checking to make sure. I want to open it up and we'll let you know. That you kind of have to do that.
And also, it'll help sort the problem out, because once they get started, people get a little bit tired of getting these calls, and they're just like, well, let's try and find a more secure way.
Here's a thought. Maybe as a business, set up a website for your business that lets people do purchase orders on the website.
Yep.
Now, I know if you're doing government orders, there's a certain process they have to go through, and they have to send you a form and all that stuff. But to whatever degree you can eliminate attachments in your life is the degree that you're going to eliminate malware in your life. It's worth it.
I mean, if you want to be really paranoid, you save the attachment, take it to an air-gapped PC, and run it in that.
Oh, that's an interesting idea.
You know, it's such a pain in the fundament to do that, that you just might as well just, you know, give somebody a quick call and know what you're getting.
Paranoia is good. I mean,
only the paranoid survive. It's the motto of Silicon Valley.
Almost always, these emails don't pass the sniff test. They don't look like a PO. They don't seem like it was written by the customer that you
and
would
always
know.
Check the email header as well.
That's
the absolute key point.
If it came from your customer server, that's a good sign.
Yeah, I mean, it's less likely, but unless they, as you say,
they've been
hacked, in which case, all bets are off.
Right. Hey, we had fun. I always like seeing you. It's great to see you again.
It's always good fun, Leo.
TheRegister.co.uk. What are you just back from DEF CON? Anything else you're working on?
I'm back from DEF CON. I've spent the last week interviewing members of the Congressional EMP Commission and various other things about the
electromagnetic pulse.
Indeed. About the possibilities of the North Koreans, or best Korea as they like to be known, actually launching an attack. And so
instead of a destructive bomb, you launch an air blast, air
about
burst.
50 to 80 miles up.
That establish, it's still an atomic bomb, but instead of it being destructive to property, it sends an electromagnetic pulse that's destructive to electronics.
Yes.
Is that real?
Oh, yes, totally. And it makes sense from a Korean perspective, because while they may have the bomb, and that's, you know,
we still don't know that.
And the missiles work occasionally.
Right.
They don't have nose cone technology. They've never successfully tested the kind of high heat resisting nose cone technology.
So you could re-enter the atmosphere.
Actually re-enter the atmosphere, beat air compression and actually get it down onto the ground. But if you explode it 50, 80 kilometers up, then you can disrupt the power systems, the internet back gnomes. I know, it has made me
wrong. Are we prepared for that?
No, we're not even close to being prepared for it.
It's pretty hard to prepare for
it. One of the main transformers, which you're using to step current from a power plant down to something you can print on the lines, America has outsourced production of these to China and Germany. They're incredibly complex to build. It takes 22 months to get a new one under the best of conditions, and they are incredibly expensive, so very few of these things have been stockpiled. Now, if you got a big enough explosion, the Congressional Committee did some work on this at the turn of the century, and if you got, not a North Korean situation, because they've only got these piddling little 20 kiloton nukes, but if you got four seriously large EMP-optimized devices going across at the four corners of the U.S., they estimate 90% population reduction within 12 months.
Four? It would just take four?
Four. And that's because no power, no water, no... Yeah, so...
Here's the good news.
And that lovely piece coming out on this in the next day or so.
We would unleash fire and fury in such a situation. Mutually assured destruction. It's protected us since 1945.
Yeah. Yes, it's... although that did always...
What a world.
I very nearly started the article. There's a maniac on the loose with nuclear weapons. And also North Korea's worrying as well.
But. We'll catch more of your work at register.co.uk. I hope you will come back. We do the new Screensavers every Saturday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, right after the radio show, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 2200 UTC. If you tune in, you can watch live at twit.tv/live, and we leave all the dirty bits in. All the nudity, stuff like that. But if
you told me that the cameras are off, I'm just.
No, you don't want to see that.
No, really don't.
I promise, no nudity, promise. And while you're in the live stream, do join us in the chat room. I can't promise there will be no nudity there. irc.twit.tv is a lot of fun. Those kids in the back of the class. But if you want to be in the studio, we'll put some seats out for you. We have a nice studio audience today. Just email tickets at twit.tv. We'll send you directions. If I'm on vacation or whatever, we'll send you what other hosts will be here. Tickets at twit.tv. Now, we do have a newsletter that lets you know what shows are coming up, what we're going to plan, and you can get that for free. I promise no salesman will call twit.tv/newsletter. And if you can't participate live, we've always got on-demand versions of everything we do at our website, twit.tv. In this case, twit.tv/NSS for the new Screensavers. Or you can subscribe. We had a visitor today who was saying, well, I don't like the podcast application on iOS, and I don't like iTunes. What can I use? There's so many great programs out there. Of course, we've got the great Twit programs. There are many programs for many platforms. We don't write any of them, just fans. Thank you. But there's also great podcast applications. We recommend Pocket Casts. That's what I use.
One of the ones I use, yep.
That's one for audio and video. If it's just audio, Marco's Overcast is very good. But find an app you like, and then look for new Screensavers and subscribe, so you don't want to miss an episode. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on the new Screensavers. Bye-bye. Marmite! More Marmite!